Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Boston's longest day is finally over. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 19th of April. Good, as always, to have you with us. Greater Boston is back in business tonight. Watertown included. Just a couple of minutes ago, Boston police confirmed the second suspect is in custody. Kurt Nickisch from WBUR is in Watertown. Kurt, good to have you with us.
It's great to be with you, Kai.
So what happened? All I saw on my Twitter feed and on local television from Boston was cheers going up as the crowd sort of gathered.
Yeah, absolutely. The police had basically surrounded a boat in a yard that was just outside of the core area where they had been searching, and were able to convince the suspect to give himself up which is just unbelievable. It takes a huge weight off of the minds of everybody here in Watertown and all around Boston, and I'll tell you that business is going to be good at bars tonight.
I bet it will. What's it like there in Watertown? Are you seeing people actually come out of their houses now, finally, after this long day?
Yeah, and they did a few hours ago when the governor lifted the restriction. They basically conceded that they had not been able to find the suspect within this core 20-block area that they had been searching so carefully. And in fact, this, where the suspect was found, was just outside of this zone. So people had started coming out, and that may have actually been the break in finding the suspect, people starting to come out of their homes and noticing something that wasn't quite right. But that was happening around Boston. But everybody was coming out really with this worry that the suspect was still out there somewhere. So this changes everything.
In addition to the bars, I imagine regular businesses in and around Boston will be greeting the dawn of Saturday morning with eagerness and commerce, yes?
Yeah, and it did. Some of that business did begin this evening, but when the restrictions were lifted, it happened pretty late in the day, and everybody had been told to stay home. So at the time that the public transportation here, and that the buses started running, that's normally the time people start heading home. People were home already, so people did go out. They visited some stores, they picked up groceries, started doing things like that. Tomorrow it really begins in earnest.
Kurt Nickisch from WBUR in Boston. We got him in Watertown, where the second suspect in the Marathon bombing has been arrested this evening. He's on his way to the hospital, actually, is what we're told. Kurt, thanks very much.
You got it.
So you take a metropolitan area of, what, 4 million people plus or minus, and you try to lock it down tight. Tough enough to do, even with instructions, but how much is it going to cost you once you figure it out, and how do you get it done? Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick made the call early this morning, and quickly and systematically, the lockdown was underway. Peter Boynton is the co-director of the Costas Research Institute for Homeland Security at Northeastern University in Boston. He says the fact that a lockdown of this size happened so fast and so smoothly is because of investments at the federal, state, and local levels made after the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001.
Additional and helpful equipment, staffing and personnel, and then also training and exercising.
New emergency notification systems like Alert Boston got the word out citywide, but also at the neighborhood level by email and text message. Law enforcement used social media and electronic billboards. They went through photos and videos from hundreds of surveillance cameras installed across Greater Boston. And all that costs money.
Typically, equipment of this sort in the post-9/11 era has been paid for to a large degree by federal grants.
Grants that also paid for personnel and for improving how first responders communicate. Brian Jackson is a security expert with the RAND Corporation. He marvels at the scale and the scope of this operation and the technology involved.
You can only imagine sort of the amount of tactical communication that's required to coordinate searches of this magnitude.
But when the accountants add all this up and It won't be for a while. Jackson says the biggest line item isn't going to be equipment. It's going to be the manhunt.
The price tag for the operation itself, you know, is measured in the overtime and the, you know, the costs paid to have all of those people out and doing the searching.
Overtime, he says, that's going to cost millions. Peter Judge is a spokesman for the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency. I asked him if he could ballpark it for me, the equipment, the training, the thousands of police officers.
It's going to be a very big number, but right now we're not worried about what the costs are.
The priority, he says, is the safety of everyone in the region. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a touch better than break even for the week, though. Not so great. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We have arrived at that place in the broadcast on a Friday where we take a couple of minutes, regroup, and try to figure out what happened. There was, in fact, news of business in the economy this week. Just seems like a long time ago. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Felix Salmon from Reuters are in our studios in New York. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, so Felix, let's talk Reinhardt, Rogoff, and debt. I'm talking, of course, about that paper by Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhardt on austerity and how important it can be in times of high debt for economic growth that was a little bit discredited this week, right?
They put together this Excel spreadsheet and really just took an average of a column, but they missed out a bunch of the rows when they took the average, and so they got the answer completely wrong. And it took a couple of grad students at the University of Massachusetts or something thereabouts Amherst to find this and more or less completely discredit this idea that after 90% of GDP, a lot of debt is a problem for countries.
Okay, wait. Completely discredit is a little harsh, no, Lee?
Well, look, I mean, debt is still a problem. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. But I mean, look, you have to at least, you know, you could see the Saturday Night Live skits being written or
I would pay money to see a Saturday Night Live skit about Reinhardt and Rogoff and economics.
This could be the week. I mean, it's funny. It is. You have to note the irony. I mean, it's like when I go to my hairdresser, you know, I don't know how to do what he does, but I do expect him to cut it evenly. You know,
it's actually even more basic than that. If you can't literally just add up a row of numbers in this Excel spreadsheet. And the other thing is that people really took this 90% number to heart. If there's one thing that everyone in the world knows about Reinhardt and Rogoff, it's that 90% is really dangerous. After that level, you're in this kind of red zone. And it turns out that number, even if things become worse gradually, slowly, as you get more debt. There's nothing special about 90%.
But wait a minute. You're not satisfied just saying, listen, debt is bad and we should be careful? Is that not?
I'm certainly not satisfied saying that, because as long as we believe that, we get, you know, Simpson and Bowles rolling each other back out onto the public stage.
Which is, in fact, what happened today.
Trying to scare, you know, Congress into making these enormous cuts, which are clearly going to hurt the country and hurt, you know, everyone who is the government is spending money on. And people think this is a problem when there's really no evidence that it's much of a problem at all.
So, Lee, what happens now? I mean, the debate's not going to change, right? I think the austerity meme, pardon the phrase, is already out there.
No, I mean, that's exactly the thing. And I think what we saw with the first Simpson Bowles, it's like, yes, it made a big difference. It got people talking. But look what happened in Washington. I mean, the two sides are so far apart that the likelihood of coming to any agreement just feels further and further far afield.
All right. Changing of gears. How worried are you guys about a springtime slowdown? Commodity prices are down. The stock market is wavering. Felix?
Well, the commodity which fell the most was gold, which is good news because it means the people aren't afraid anymore. Gold is a fear commodity. And so if gold falls, that means maybe people are thinking of putting their money into something genuinely productive rather than a useless lump of gold metal. So
But Lee, I mean, oil's been down. I don't know what it did today, but oil's been down, which is traditionally a sign of worries about slower demand because people aren't, you know, using as much energy.
That's true. But I think if you look at the corporate story, you know, the stock market, if you look at corporate profits, the efficiency and productivity, that story among corporate America just continues to, if anything, accelerate. So I think we're seeing, you know, the further decoupling of what's happening on Wall Street and Main Street, perhaps. I think jobs are still a huge problem. But I don't think we're risking falling off a cliff like we have kind of the past couple Mays.
Felix?
We?
Yes, no, maybe.
I'm sanguine. There are lots of things which could go wrong, of course, but I'm not going to start looking at a bunch of obscure commodity indicators and panicking just yet.
Well, what about like things like falling yield on the 10-year T-note? You worried about that at all?
Yes.
Not to get all bondalicious on
yeah,
you.
No,
you're,
no,
your
you touched my sweet spot
you
there, Kai.
You got me on that one.
You know I care about the bonds.
Boom, baby.
That one worries me. It does. I'll admit to that.
I'm gonna yield on 10-year term.
I'm declaring the field declaring victory, departing the field. Felix Salmon.
Drop the mic.
I know. Felix Salmon from Reuters. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. You guys have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. Bye bye. The National Rifle Association improved on its record of success this week with the defeat of the gun bill in the Senate. The NRA is, if not the, then certainly one of the most effective lobbying groups around. And on the theory that nothing succeeds like success, lobbyists for all sorts of other causes are wondering how they might crib the secrets of the NRA's playbook. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
This is the kind of thing the NRA can do on a dime.
We have a constitutional right to bear arms, and that's what this is all about.
It can organize big rallies on short notice. This one was in Albany, New York recently.
They are a well-oiled machine.
Jim Thurber has taught a how-to lobbying course at American University for 30 years. The NRA is so good, Thurber says, he brings in their chief lobbyist to talk to students. Thurber says the NRA does have a lot of money, but the real lesson here is how it organizes its members to pressure lawmakers.
So they have, you know, at least 180,000 that are immediately reactive to anything that's going on through the internet. They get mobilized and send a message.
Toby Moffitt knows some of the targets of those messages. He's a former member of Congress who now lobbies, mostly on behalf of foreign countries. He says some House Democrats told him they were amazed at how their incoming emails suddenly turned against gun control during the recent debate.
Their mail had totally flipped from 5-1 in favor of doing something to 5-1 against doing something. Now, that didn't just happen by accident. That was the NRA.
Even though Moffitt is a gun control supporter, he appreciates the NRA's lobbying prowess. He uses similar tactics to build citizen coalitions for his clients. Steve Fox is also a lobbyist. He's with the Marijuana Policy Project, which wants to change federal laws on pot. He tries to emulate the NRA's ability to frame an issue in terms of fundamental rights.
They are focused on guns. We are focused on marijuana. They're similar in that way. It's sort of a individual liberty issue.
Fox's group has even tried to join forces with the NRA to overturn a law that prohibits marijuana users from owning guns. But so far, the NRA isn't interested. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, Shamu and the Stock Exchange for Reals.
Even when the economy isn't doing well, theme parks tend to be a popular substitute for people who may have considered more expensive vacation destinations.
But first, let's do the numbers. So-so day in the markets, but a lousy week. The Dow Industrials added 10 points today, less than a 10%, 14,547 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ picked up 39 points, 1.25%, 3206 at the bell. The S&P 500 tacked on 13 points, 0.9%, thanks for asking, finished at 1555. For the week, the worst of the year, should you be keeping track? The Dow and the S&P both shed 2.1%. The NASDAQ tumbled 2.7% today. The big story in the markets was IBM. Shares of Big Blue lost more than 8%, the biggest loss for that company in years following a weak earnings report. Shares of Anheuser-Busch InBev frothed up 1.75% today. The world's biggest beer maker said it had reached a settlement allowing it to acquire the parent company of Corona. Although, again, why you want to own that beer is beyond me. Airline stocks took flight after carriers sued to stop furloughs of air traffic controllers. Shares of Southwest soared nearly 3%. United Continental lifted 1.2% today. Meantime, the FAA has cleared the way for Boeing's troubled 787 to return to the skies. Boeing shares cruised more than 2% higher today. And you, well, you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Senate Judiciary Committee is scheduled to hold a hearing on immigration reform. The National Association of Realtors reports on existing home sales for March. And Monday is Earth Day. Do something nice for your planet. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's not just high school seniors who check their email obsessively this time of year. College seniors, law school aspirants in particular, are eager for news of their futures, too. And for the bright young students that do get in, the thrill comes with the cold reality of tens, perhaps even $100,000 worth of debt. Trevor Morrison has a thrill of his own coming this spring. The Columbia Law School professor is going to become the dean of NYU Law School coming up this June. Trevor Morrison, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So congratulations, first of all, on the new gig. But I do kind of have to wonder whether this is an opportune time to be the dean of a law school. I mean, there's lots of lawyers out there. Salaries aren't necessarily holding up. It's expensive.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled and really deeply honored to be coming aboard at NYU. But you're right. This is a challenging time for legal education and the legal profession more broadly. I think one thing that excites me so much about joining NYU is how well positioned it is to address those challenges.
What about, though, kids like, say, me, who was a solid B student coming out of college, did fair to not so good on the LSATs, on the law boards, and yet still has to pony up quite a bit of money to get that law degree, should I want to, from a not-such-a-name institution?
You know, I think I'm going to resist giving prescriptions for what law school applicants or potential law school applicants across the country should do, what decisions they should make. I wouldn't presume to speak for that. I guess the way I would put it is the decision whether to go to law school at all and the decision whether to pursue a legal education at a place like NYU, if one is afforded that opportunity, are just not the same decisions.
What's your obligation as the dean of this law school or the incoming dean of this law school to make sure your students are employable?
I think that's certainly part of what any law school should understand to be part of its mission. And the goal is not simply to find jobs for our graduates, but to help them pursue the employment they most want to pursue. And so that moves across the private sector, of course. And in particular at NYU, we have a longstanding tradition of excellence in public interest work.
I wonder along those lines, actually, whether, and just looking at your background, I mean, you've done a bunch of clerkships. You clerked for Justice Ginsburg on the Supreme Court, which is admirable. But I wonder whether students now, with the debt load they have coming out, are having to choose corporate law and its remunerative powers versus the kind of law that actually might be of the greater public good.
Well, I think one can see public good in all manner of legal work, private sector and public sector alike. There can be greater challenges for people who want to pursue careers in areas that tend to be less remunerative than the private sector. At NYU, all graduates working in public interest related jobs with income of $80,000 a year or less can qualify for 100% loan repayment assistance through the law school.
Is being a lawyer still a good job, do you think, writ large?
Absolutely. One thing I learned during my most recent time in government, in the White House, a very high percentage of the people I worked with each day had as their underlying professional training a legal education. You can tell the same story about an incredible wide variety of career paths for people with legal education in the private sector. So, yeah, I think the value proposition of a legal education, of a top-level legal education, is clear and really has never been clearer.
Trevor Morrison, he will in June become the new dean of the law school at New York University. Here I was going to call you Dean Morrison. I think that's right.
A little early.
Trevor, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
On something like this, you're really trying not to do the same thing that every other broadcast out there is doing, but at the same time, cover the story. So we've called Wesley Morris. We have him on every now and then to talk about movies. He is up in Boston. Wesley, it's good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Kai.
This is one of those, and this is part of why we called you, this is one of those where people say, man, this is like out of some movie or something, you know?
You know what? These pieces are sort of like, oh my God, this is just like the movie stories always sort of bug me a little bit when they don't really seem entirely appropriate, but a good writer can make it make sense. I'm just not feeling that today.
Yeah, yeah. There are, though, a lot of sci-fi movies out now which are apocalyptic, which are, you know, grim and not all that pleasant.
Yeah, no, I mean, we seem to be getting at least one every 2 weeks. This week's is Oblivion, the Tom Cruise movie. Yeah. But I think that people seem to, it's a disaster movie. People seem to like those when they're well done. But I wonder whether people will want to see that this weekend. I don't know.
You could see a case where people would just want to escape, right? They would just want to get out and not have anything to do with reality at all.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess what would you be seeing? Like The Croods or, I mean, the top 10 movies are all, with the exception of 42 and The Croods, they're all sort of violent, apocalyptic or horror movies. Or they involve like terrorism of some kind, G.I. Joe Retaliation, Evil Dead, Olympus Has Fallen. You know, you've got two movies in which the White House is sort of under siege. That's, you know, and the president.
So spitball it for me. On the Monday box office, are those apocalypse movies you're going to see the hit or no?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. It's a good question. I'm going to assume that the box office is going to be down in general. And I also think that people aren't going to be that interested in seeing Tom Cruise at the end of days, basically. It's such a standard movie in so many ways, but in light of what's going on around us, it just seems so absurd that it's neither escapism nor is it realism, and it just has nothing to do with anything in a strange sense.
Wesley Morris, he writes on movies and a bunch of other stuff at Grantland. We got him in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Wesley, thanks a lot, man.
Thank you, Kai.
All right, quick. What's black and white, weighs 10,000 pounds, and is now publicly traded? If you guessed Shamu, go straight to the head of the class. SeaWorld Entertainment is now listed on the New York Stock Exchange, in part because SeaWorld and a bunch of other theme parks have been performing pretty well this year, despite concerns about consumer spending. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that story.
So apparently for a lot of you out there, this is fun. That's some poor child upside down on a giant swing at an amusement park. And much like the children whose earnest screams fuel it, the $13 billion a year theme park industry is proving resilient. Revenues grew 3% last year, and attendance at big California parks rose by double digits.
Even when the economy isn't doing well, theme parks tend to be a popular substitute for people who may have considered more expensive vacation destinations.
Robert Niles is editor of ThemeParkInsider.com. He says many of the big amusement parks have made major investments in new characters and attractions. Universal opened the Wizarding World of Harry Potter in 2010, for example.
SeaWorld's about to debut a new $100 million-plus attraction in Orlando based on Antarctica with penguins, which people love penguins. They're cute.
And those investments are paying off. SeaWorld, which has 11 theme parks, has swung from a loss to a surging profit in just 2 years. Sawyer Stroud is a character performer at Disney and Universal in Florida.
During the spring break, Easter peak season, it's the busiest I've ever seen the parks in the 7 years that I've been here.
Nima Samadi with Ibis World says the rising share prices of theme parks are also a sign that investors are expecting the economy and discretionary consumer spending to improve.
The kind of story with this is as the economy recovers, so will amusement and theme parks continue to grow.
In other words, the economic roller coaster ride may be coming to an end. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, ticker symbol DNKN picked up 1% and a bit today. Analysts will tell you it was because business at Dunkin' Donuts is pretty good. I, however, would like to think it's because Wall Street knows a good deed when it sees it. In the middle of the insanity in Boston today came this news. The Dunkin' Donuts outlets there would stay open despite the lockdown order to make sure that all police and first responders would be taken care of. You can make all the jokes you like about cops and donuts right about here, but I do think you got to be thankful for them today. Just to wrap it up for you before we go, 19-year-old Jokhart Tsarnaev was arrested tonight after a day-long lockdown of Boston and a standoff in Watertown this evening that lasted about 3 hours. And so late of a Friday, that is Marketplace from 8 p.m. Today, the Dow up 10 points, less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ picked up 39 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 tacked on 13 points. That is 0.9%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yor is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, what is really behind those four little words, made in the USA?
There's a very strong perception that American companies treat their workers better and that there's more of a sense of a social conscience, giving back to the community.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. It's been a long couple of days. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.